We can't predict the future. That's both true and untrue. At a physical level, we can never know what the coming day will hold, let alone 50 or more years from now. However, we can equally say with confidence that the physical nature of the world will be the same tomorrow and in 50 years or 50 million years. We can also model probabilities about the physical future because we know that this physical nature remains constant. If we drink everything in a glass of water, we know it's not going to fill up again of its own accord. My bank account, unfortunately, doesn't miraculously generate money. If we smoke, we can model a future that includes a high likelihood of lung cancer. The same holds true in the universe as we see it in grace. No one can predict what God will do, how grace will materialize. Every time we think we've come to think that we can predict God, whether through scriptural interpretations or spiritual discernment, God does something utterly different, almost as if to confound us in our pride. To live by grace is to live life on the edge, never knowing what lies ahead. Yet, equally, grace is utterly predictable, to a degree of certainty that at least matches our confidence in the physical nature of the universe. We know that whatever grace gives us, it is good. It proceeds from love. It is creative, supportive, even when we're experiencing it as breaking us down, even into death itself. The goodness and love of God experienced in our lives as grace is as certain as the force of gravity in the physical realm. Furthermore, we can model spiritual outcomes just as we can model physical outcomes. This is the power of the prophetic ministry within the church community. Yes, there's a dimension of the charism of a word from God that is revelatory, even though this is always ambiguous, even to the receiver of the prophetic word. Every preacher who is in tune with God knows that still small voice that says, "This is my word through you." That's the scariest part of all preaching. But for the most part, the prophetic word arises from illumination of life by the spiritual vision that says that the pathway of grace leads to discernible outcomes. From this vision arises both the prophetic warning and the prophetic encouragement. Let's be very honest, though, and acknowledge that the prophetic ministry is always ambiguous, and that throughout history and in the experience recorded in the pages of Scripture, false prophets outnumber true prophets, and even those we may account as true prophets got a lot very wrong. It's always been one of the major struggles of the church community in every age, reaching right back to the Hebrew tradition, to know whether a prophet is speaking true or false. When we set ourselves to look ahead at where the church might be in 50 years, we're engaging in this dimension of prophetic ministry. But this highlights another critical part of our understanding of prophecy. It's not about the future. It's about the present. It's no concern of ours to know what the state of the church might be in 50 years. The prophetic word is a call to the present. But it's saying that the decisions we make in this present shape the outcomes as they will be in the future. At a physical level, humanity at the global level faces two alternative scenarios that will play out over the coming century. There's no middle way, no muddling through. The one scenario is the disastrous disintegration of all organized human society, the complete breakdown of civilized life in all parts of the planet. Potentially, even our complete extinction as a species. If we carry on the way we are at this moment, this outcome is certain. The alternative scenario is that we develop a completely new way of living, one that meets each and every one of the threats that hang over us. That's why the readings in Jeremiah that have been part of the daily offices throughout Lent are such an important word to our day. The terrible warnings that Jeremiah uttered, warnings that often repel us with their graphic imagery of violence and mayhem, are warnings to our world that disaster is just around the corner. And the sufferings that Jeremiah portrayed are very real possibilities for our world. They eventuated for Judah. Jeremiah's message, amend your ways and your doings, is the prophetic message to our age. Jeremiah was ignored in his lifetime, and the consequences followed. We ignore the call in our day, and the consequences will certainly follow. I wish to conclude this Lenten series by taking this week and next week these two scenarios of the future and look at what we can do to prepare ourselves as a Christian community. Realistically, you and I can't do much to change which of these outcomes will eventuate. We can play our part, but we're small cogs in a huge movement of both physical and spiritual nature. In all the reading of the book of Jeremiah, it's one small chapter that has for me the most sense of personal identification. It's chapter 45. Now, you may recall that Jeremiah dictates his prophecies to his scribe Barak, and he's been predicting the fall of Jerusalem, and now these events are taking place. And this 45th chapter is about Barak. The word that the prophet Jeremiah addressed to Barak, son of Neriah, when the latter wrote these words down in a book at Jeremiah's dictation, in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, son of Josiah, king of Judah. This is what the Lord God of Israel says about you, Barak. You have been thinking, what disaster for me! And the Lord has added further grief to my troubles. I am worn out with groaning and find no relief. Say to him as follows. The Lord says this. Now I am knocking down what I have built and uprooting what I have planted over the whole country. And you ask for special treatment? Don't ask. For I am now going to bring disaster on all humanity, the Lord declares. But you I shall allow to escape with your life, wherever you may go. We are caught up in this global movement that, if we see this through Jeremiah's eyes, while it is a physical phenomena that has physical roots and origins, yet seen through the eyes of grace, it is an act of God, a creative act of God. And you and I are caught up in that, and we cannot ask for special treatment. Today, I wish to address the scenario of disaster. Next week, the prospect of real change leading to a new way of living. This is not a message that is all doom and gloom. It is looking to the future and recognizing that all may be doom and gloom. How will we cope when and if that time comes? If we need a representation of what could be the human condition in every part of the globe, look no further than Syria today. Over the past few days, it's been revealed that both Antarctic ice shelves are melting at an alarming rate. And if they disappear, the ocean levels around the globe will rise by 6 meters. Vast areas of the Earth's land will be sea, including much of northern Europe and Asia. Coastal cities will be inundated. Billions of people will be dislocated, and land lost to agriculture will create a gigantic food crisis. This is just one of the challenges confronting us, not even the greatest. Much of this is going to happen, whatever scenario we see in the future. The difference is that in next week's scenario, we look at the situation where global humanity rises above the challenges and learns to live with them in a creative way. This week, we must face the very real possibility that the crises overwhelm us and global humanity enters a collapse of social order from which we may never emerge, not at least for centuries or millennia. How do we as Christians prepare ourselves and our church for this frightening possibility? The worst possible response we can have is to think that God is going to come riding in to save us, or that Jesus is going to return sometime soon and set everything right. This is pure wishful thinking, illusionism. And those who promote this fits Jeremiah's description of the false prophets who cry, "Peace, peace, where there is no peace." Ezekiel condemns those who plaster over cracks in the wall. In this religion operates on the same plane as those who believe that technology will save us. So how do we prepare ourselves? Like everything, it begins with the small things, with what immediately confronts us. The foundation for the way we will cope when global catastrophe hits us is laid in what you do today. Life is full of loss. Every day is a succession of deaths. Even the passing minutes, given our relatively short lifespan, is a loss, a death. Even when we're not facing loss at this moment, we know it lies in the future. I often look at my two adored cats and know that one day I'll lose them, let alone the much more important relationships in my life. I know what it means to come face to face with the probability of one's own immediate death that brings the loss of everything material and personal. There are practical things we can do to address some anxieties about the future. I live in a city built on 50 volcanic cones, the field still active though dormant for the last 600 years. I have a survival kit with food and water and other essential requirements to survive a few days in a crisis. But nothing can physically prepare us, for example, for the situation in Port Vila, trapped in the eye of one of the worst storms the planet has seen. Nothing could physically prepare us for being caught up in a Syria-like situation. Furthermore, we don't know from which direction disaster could strike. We can't physically prepare for every possible eventuality. No, the essential preparation has to be within ourselves. And the core of that preparation has to be spiritual. Our natural instincts as Christians is to speak of God as our rock, our refuge, our support in times of trouble. And I'll return to that. However, in my experience, the most important foundation is to recognize the elemental truth that I learnt first from theologian Thomas Oden, that God is the slayer of all values. It is God who destroys everything we value, including ultimately our lives. This may seem a hard lesson to learn and can easily be turned into the idea that God is cruel, but I want to testify to this. God has slain a lot of values in my life, some that were intensely precious to me. But always, when I look back, I see that the slaying led to new life. Always grace, always recognized as an act of love, and always, always, resurrection follows the death. From that flows a basic stance about everything in life. That everything I count as value is offered to God to slay, There's no holding back. There's no saying to God, this far and no further. In other words, even the most cherished values of faith and church, belief and practice, nothing lies outside the scope of the God who slays every value. This, I say to you, is the single most important theological insight we need as we face the sureness of loss. Whether it be the breaking of our favorite cup, or the total loss of global civilization and every cultural idea and artifact we think is important, even to the church itself. This surely is the centrality of the cross to our faith. In the gospel records as we have them, Jesus is portrayed as not only seeing his death, but as teaching the disciples to expect his resurrection. I suspect this is a conception in hindsight. If we could ever reach the reality, I think we'd find that for the disciples, the crucifixion was experienced as the destruction of all faith and hope. The symbol of the cross and the resurrection faith that was to spring from that event stands to us as the proclamation that God slays every value, even the life of Jesus, but that on the other side of every slaying lies resurrection. The idea of redemption, so central to the gospel proclamation, I find of daily importance in my life. This is my experience. Things go wrong, always. Sometimes small and passing. Sometimes my own fault, sometimes others, and often it's just how things fall out, nobody's fault. More deeply, we can never do right. Because everything we do involves a choice not to fulfill some other value, causing loss. Now there's a physical response to things going wrong, practical measures to be taken. But the real power, I find, is in switching even for an instant into the grace mode and seeing God, both in the event that has gone wrong, but more importantly, that God redeems the event, the moment. I say this to you, in my experience, God never fails to redeem when life events are offered in this way. Resurrection always follows Good Friday's crucifixion. Armed with this faith, we can face anything. No matter whether it's the breaking of our favorite cup or being caught up in the onslaught of ISIS or Cyclone Pam. Be it the death of our cat or Earth being hit by a mile-wide asteroid. The image of God as the slayer of every value is counterbalanced by the image of God as our rock, our refuge, our place of safety, our shelter in the storm. This doesn't mean that God shelters us from the realities of suffering, loss, and death. Countless Christians have lost their faith because they saw God as the guarantor of the safety and well-being of themselves and their family or enterprise. As a hospital chaplain over the years, I can't count the number of instances of spiritual disillusionment that I've had to pastor. There are certain approaches to religion that build upon what people wish for, promising that God will deliver if the people will fulfill certain conditions. And that form of religion always leads, finally, to disillusionment, and more often than not, to rejection of belief. I have a rule of thumb, and like every rule of thumb, there are situations it doesn't apply. My rule of thumb is this. If I can express a prayer as, I wish you would do whatever, God, then I don't pray it. Here's the paradox, though. God's not the fulfiller of our wishes, rather, as explored earlier, the destroyer of our wishes. Yet, when I see what God has done in my life, I know that all my deepest wishes have been fulfilled, but in ways utterly beyond anything I could have imagined to have wished for. So here's the key. Don't interpret God is my rock and my refuge, as meaning that God will preserve what you value or deliver what you wish for, even if your values are what you see as gospel values, and your wishes what you see as must be God's wishes. If you take that path, you'll be either disillusioned or, as so many Christians become, angry and hostile towards the world that they see as subverting God's work, and anger often directed at other Christians. A while back, I sat in a congregation appalled at the bitterness being expressed in the prayers. I recall those people with sadness, even though they spoke of the joy of the gospel. Rather, open your eyes to see grace at work in everything, everywhere, even in the catastrophes of nature or the ravages of religious idealists. Our refuge is the faith recognition that nothing is ever a disaster, that God's grace triumphs in everything, from the smallest atom to the birth and death of stars, from the minutiae of our daily life to the sweep of global events. Here then is the double-sided faith that will carry us through anything and everything life may hold for us. This day, and into the worst of all possible scenarios of global disaster that may be painted as being our potential future. God is the slayer of every value. It may seem scandalous to say it, but nothing, nothing at all is sacred to God, not even religion, not even our most cherished values and beliefs. Not even the scriptures, and certainly not the moral laws and commandments we've constructed. Sadly, not even my cats. I can go so far as to say that the instant we put a fence around any value and say, this is untouchable, it's in that very instant that it's about to be destroyed by God. That's the one side. The other is to open our eyes to see grace in everything. Everywhere, without limit or exception. As God destroys, so God creates. Grace is ever building a new creation. Grace fills the situation in Iraq and Syria, in Vanuatu, in all life's tragedies, small and great. Faith doesn't shelter us from the cross. Faith leads us, all of us, to the cross. We are, however, not like Jesus' disciples who couldn't see beyond the destruction of their hopes. We know the power of resurrection faith. That's the difference. Armed with that faith, we can face whatever the future may hold, personal and global, and know that there never, ever will come a time when we can't gather in prayer and Eucharist and say, let us give thanks.